The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
Revolution comes with a price tag. You a slave to a flag in a country that clearly doesn't love you when they probably never have. Told you turn the other cheek, and they made it with a bat. Fucking protesting them citizens. Told you go fight in the war. Vietnam, you died, good riddance. The man of the house rule took you from your siblings. Turned around a pump crack right up in your city. And they turned all your leaders to martyrs. You was off in the war, now who was guarding your daughters? It was riots in the streets, killed Malcolm and Martin. Called a national guard up because we ride with our guard up. And that was blood in your guard. The Second Amendment don't apply to you. Everything that they taught you was a lie to you. See, they scared of your skin and they dying to shoot. Take the American dream and then you die to pursue.
One day it'll all make sense. If it ain't about power, then it don't make sense. But none of that money matters when you live in madness. The one that you figure out that all you got is this. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger.
Good afternoon. You are tuned in to Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed, and I'm broadcasting from behind these enemy lines known as USA Inc. Today's date is March the 7th. It is of the year 2016, as they say. And we do have a guest schedule for you all today. And hopefully this will be an information-packed program. Hope to make you think about things critically, analytically. And but we will be joined here in just a few minutes by Christopher Irvin, a longtime friend of Black Talk Radio Network, an abolitionist, a modern new abolitionist, because he is against 21st century slavery and human trafficking as prescribed by the U.S. Constitution's 13th Amendment. Mr. Irvin is one of probably the only one, the only abolitionist candidate running for a political position anywhere in the United States in 2016. As far as we can tell, now Bernie Sanders, I wouldn't exactly call him an abolitionist candidate, but he has proposed legislation that would eliminate certain aspects of modern day slavery, but he has not declared himself an abolitionist. And I've never heard him talk about the exception clause for slavery in the 13th Amendment. But so we're going to talk to Christopher Irvin. He is running for District 5 for the Baltimore City Council in Baltimore, Maryland, of course. And he'll be joining us today. The general election in Maryland will take place next month on April the 26th. He is facing off against six different candidates. All of the candidates appear to be running as Democrats. We have posted a little bit of his bio and linked to his campaign's Facebook page if you want to check that out. But again, he's a friend of the show. He's no stranger to the Black Talk Radio Network. He's been on not only this program, but as an abolitionist, of course, he's been a guest on New Abolitionist Radio to discuss all the different activities that he was engaged in the state of Maryland to combat racism and white supremacy in its institutional forms through the criminal justice system. And he's not what they call a so-called one-issue candidate. I don't even know where that, well, yeah, that's coming from the Hillary Clinton campaign and calling people one-issue candidates. But he has also worked in the city on issues impacting youth and families, as well as seniors, of course, there, you know, in the family and the developmentally disabled. And he says that he is committed to pushing for social justice and has developed strong relationships with grassroots community organizations fighting for fair and equitable treatment of vulnerable individuals and underserved communities. So, you know, Baltimore is back in the news again, embroiled in yet another police brutality scandal, with a cop being caught on video that was shown on national news networks, where you have a cop assaulting a teenager who the police alleged was trespassing on school property and mouthing off to officials, but many people, like myself, thought that the officer did not handle that properly and professionally and committed a crime when he engaged in assaulting that teenager. And you had the other cops who were just watching, did not intervene and try to rein in their colleague and say, hey, man, you're going a little bit too far there. We don't like smart alecky kids either. They mouth off, but that doesn't give you justification. Just punch them in the mouth or to slap them around and whatnot. That's not your child. You don't have the right to do that. Baltimore again is in the news. I do believe they have also a debate plan for those seeking the mayor. Position of mayor in Baltimore, as of the current mayor, I forget her name for some reason, her name is escaping me, but she is not running, and y'all seen her, cause she has been on the news a lot since the killing of Freddie Gray and his abuse at the hands of Baltimore police officers. And so she has been in the news a lot. Her first name is Stephanie for some reason. Stephanie Rollins Blake is, I believe, the mayor of Baltimore's her name. I also heard from someone, I haven't confirmed it, that Marilyn Mosby, the prosecutor, the state prosecutor in Maryland, is handling the case of the police officers involved in the killing of Freddie Gray. Her husband, I heard, is one of those candidates for mayor in Baltimore. So definitely this is the season to be discussing area number 6 of people activity. And, of course, that is politics. All right. Got a couple of other things that I will discuss as well. Last night, Senator Bernie Sanders squared off in a political debate on CNN. Did y'all see how Hillary Clinton dodged that question from Don Lemon? Oh, real quick. Don Lemon is a black man. He identifies as a black man because he said so last night. So I guess we can just, forget what he said when he interviewed Morgan Freeman, where they were talking about racism doesn't exist and, kind of denying, that people should even embrace their cultural, racial, ethnic classifications and whatnot. And so I remember he said that, and but last night he said, I'm a black man, and as a black man, I'm gonna ask you this question: were you using racial code when you were talking about super predators? And Hillary Clinton has been noted by people on social media, dodged the question. She jumped to lead in schools and all kind of mold in the school buildings and didn't answer the question, because the question, it was a question that I felt like, while it seemed like it was a straight up racial question, it was still constructed in a codified manner, because the implication is that Hillary Clinton, did you knowingly engaged in this racial code, which the implication would be that you in fact engaged in an act of racism. So therefore, from that, that's evidence that you're a racist. So she dodged that question. Did y'all pick up on that, those who watched the debates last night? And I thought Don Lemon, for all the criticism, and some of it is rightfully deserved and hopefully it's constructive, but all the criticism Don Lemon gets, he did a pretty good job of asking pointed questions last night. I don't know if he wrote his own questions or if the producers of that televised debate, if they wrote the questions and just put them in Don's name. Whoever wrote them, they were some good questions that if you read in between the lines and you're not bamboozled by buckets and buckets of words, and you can see that the woman avoided the question, which implies that she is a racist. So I'm just wondering if people caught on to that. And I shared an article on my Facebook page about, absolutely not that I needed someone to tell me, because I was a young man in the 1990s, first part of the 90s, the early years. Well, I was in the United States military, got out in 1993, I believe, or 92. And after that, I got out, started raising my family, with college. So I remember these things. I was paying attention to politics in the 90s, and I knew. I heard Rush Limbaugh and all the conservative talk radio during that time period in the United States pushing a super predator theory. And it absolutely Hillary Clinton, anybody that was alive that day, in fact, Democrats and liberals and anti-racists of that day were pointing out that, hey, this is racist. You know, you're using this to target non-white children in inner cities and whatnot. Everybody knew that. The media knew that. And it was promoted by right-wing media. So Hillary Clinton knew it, too. And she deliberately engaged in an act of racism. You know, she called it a poor choice of words and whatnot. But that's about all. She dodged the rest of her answer spent talking about, you know, misdirection, talking about, you know, other issues in Detroit and whatnot. But the question was, did you know it was racial code? And she chose to dodge and not answer that question. Another thing about the debates, the whole issue of free public colleges and universities, I don't know why people want to repeat the talking points of the Clinton campaign and say that, oh, that's just a pipe dream. That's undoable. Who's going to pay for it? I don't want to pay for Donald Trump's kids to go to school and all this and that. But yet, you know, President Obama, as late as September of 2015, renewed a push for making 2 years of community college, which is a public college, right, gets public funds and whatnot already, and making 2 years of community college free. All right, so you know, is she running from Obama? And trying, you know, as she tried to play black voters, the so-called Obama coalition, and she wants to try to act like, you know, she's so close to him and you know, they're politically or peas of the same pod and whatnot. And yeah, I know they have teamed up in foreign policy and have engaged in right-wing neoconservative liberal imperialistic policies and overthrowing countries and whatnot. I know that. But on this issue of community colleges, President Obama seems to think that people in the United States should have opportunity to at least get an associate's degree, you know, from a community college, and it should be affordable. But all Hillary Clinton wants to talk about is addressing student debt. Well, how about preventing student debt? That would be the best way to address it, don't you think? Not to say, you know, we shouldn't work on passing legislation or rules that would allow these people to refinance and whatnot, these mortgages. Yeah, you certainly do that for those people that's already, you know, saddled with that debt. But I think it's just as important, if not more important, to prevent a new generation from falling into that trap. So it is certainly doable, and it's just sad when I hear black people like my uncle, you know, feed talking points to me that he got from Hillary Clinton to make this seem like it's so undoable. Free stuff, you know, sound like Republicans say, oh, black people just want free stuff. Food, they starving, you know, they just want free stuff, you know. Yeah, whatever, man. Come on. But and last but not least, the state of North Carolina, where I live and have family roots that precede the creation of the United States of America, the state of North Carolina is asking for public comment and proposals related to a monument that is to be erected honoring the contributions of black North Carolinians. Now, I was reading an article on the Charlotte Observer, racist suspect paper. Okay, I have long suspected them of engaging in racism of the covert kind through media, but I was reading an article from there that they published on this, and of course people were talking about honoring the enslaved Africans. But the listeners, especially if you're a recent listener of Black Talk Radio News or hear me, y'all know I had this pet peeve about we are taking on this collective mindset that we're all the descendants of enslaved Africans, and that's our contribution to this country, and that's it. And we just ignore every other activity area that black people contributed in this country before it came a country, and as colonists, people who settled, you know, on this continent, immigrants or whatnot. Everybody did not come over here in chains. It is very, very important that we do acknowledge those who were victims and are victims, I would say. Not in, I don't want to talk in past tense about slavery, but it's important that we recognize the victims of the world's worst system of chattel slavery. All right, it's important that we recognize that we memorialize them, and that the nation pay reparations, you know, not just for slavery past, but slavery present, along with the institutional racism that goes along with it. But that we cannot let that be our only collective identity. That is not, in fact, it's not our identity. And I submitted my proposal, and, you know, I said, well, how about recognizing the 400 plus free Africans who fought in the Revolutionary War, and, you know, and almost every other war. You know, North Carolinians, black people, African descended people have participated, you know, in the establishment of North Carolina as a colony, in the establishment of the United States as a republic, in the Civil War, North Carolinians, black, the African descendant people stepped up, whether they were slaved or free. They stepped up, you know, to try, you know, to put an end to slavery during their time period. But, you know, they was dealing with some very crafty, slick white supremacists, and unfortunately the job isn't done, and we have to, you know, continue to press towards ending slavery in this country. But again, that is not our only identity. If you are a descendant of an enslaved African, you know, that is nothing to be ashamed of or anything like that. If your ancestors were victimized, then they were victimized. The history is what it is. But all of us were not. And I've yet to find, and I'm still doing a lot of searching, because, you know, our family trees have all these different branches. But in my direct line that's tied to this land, I am not finding any enslaved African ancestors in my family tree thus far. Now, I'm sure that I will be able to find some in the extended family because of, you know, we marrying other black people who I'm sure got enslaved Africans in their ancestral tree. Again, not trying to minimize the suffering, because indeed we trying to steal in suffering that's going on related to slavery today. But that cannot be your collective identity. There's a reason that white supremacists, that's all they tell you in school, in their education centers, so to speak, so-called education centers. That's all they talk about. That's all they talk about is you were a slave. Well, think about walking and think about how that can seep into a child's mentality. And, you know, and they grow up thinking that, you know, I'm that's part of my psyche, a victim. Always been victimized, enslaved African, I'm descendant of slaves, when in fact they may be descendants of African revolutionaries who without the United States would not even exist. This is proven fact. This is not something I'm making up. So that's what I submitted. I just want to see all of our history recognized and not just limited to victim status. You know, because we've been more than conquerors and people who have overcome tremendous odds and whatnot. Whether we were as enslaved Africans or as free people on this continent, free black people on this continent. I should have heard from Christopher by now. I do know that he was attending a function, I believe, on his Facebook page. He had posted some photos. Let me see. Let me check my Facebook messages. I do apologize. It's like going on 4:20. And we still ain't heard from Brother Christopher Urban. Let me see. I should be able to locate his phone number. I'm going to check on that. In the meantime, I will play some message music. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed, broadcasting right here on the Black Talk Radio Network from behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. Stay tuned.
I scratched up.
You're listening to the Black Talk Radio Network. Stay tuned.
No, it really isn't. Because, see, people are thinking in terms of, well, they want to brag about being black, which means that they are implying that there's something incorrect about being white, even though these are the creations of the Creator. See, and then so everybody gets into this black pride thing or white pride thing, and people immediately start taking sides. It's not about taking sides based on black and white. It's about taking sides based on justice and non-justice. Well, that's what you're really aiming for. Being black doesn't mean anything if you don't believe in justice. And being white doesn't mean anything if you don't believe in justice, except you believe in non-justice. And that doesn't make any difference what shade you are, or how tall you are, or who your cousin was, or anything like that, or what so-called nationality you have. Like a lot of people say that they take pride in being an Englishman, or take pride in being a Frenchman, or take pride in being Afrocentric. Well, you're not supposed to be proud of any of those things if you don't believe in justice, because these words mean nothing. No nationality means anything. And waving a flag if you don't believe in not mistreating people. You've got to believe in not mistreating people, and you got to believe in helping people that need help the most. Otherwise, you don't even have any business breathing.
And welcome back to Black Talk Radio News. Let me see if this is a good number for Mr. Irvin. See if we can get in touch with him. Perhaps it slipped his mind.
Hello.
Mr. Irvin, this is Scotty Reed with Black Talk Radio. We had an interview scheduled with you today. Are you able to participate?
Yes, I am, Scotty. Give me 1 second.
Oh, sure. Okay, listeners, it does sound like he's still at that hearing or event.
Yeah, I'm stepping outside right now. I'm sorry.
All right, no need. Things happen. No need to apologize. You out there engaging in the people's business.
Yes, sir. Here I am. How are you, Scotty?
Oh, I'm not going to complain to you, sir, all right, because you know all the complaints, right? You know, and you trying to do something about it, at least in Baltimore where you are. So how are you doing, sir?
I'm fine. Are we on the air now?
Yes, sir. Yes, we are.
All right, I'm glad to be with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, so it's been a few weeks or perhaps a month or so since we last spoke with you. Again, as I let the listeners know, you are running for Baltimore City Council, and the election will take place on April the 26th, 2016. So the first thing I want to get from you, Mr. Irvin, is a campaign update. Are you seeing any momentum with your campaign? What are some of the areas of need? Do you need volunteers in the area? What's going on with your campaign?
The campaign is going along very well. We always need donations. But more important than donations, we do need volunteers. The fact that people would be out sharing information, such as people receiving their right to vote back, such as information such as tomorrow, in Annapolis will be having a hearing in the House of Delegates Judiciary Committee on nonviolent felony expungement. This is a way to address that cycle of recidivism that people are worried about and the legal discrimination against people who have a felony record. And so we're always looking for people who are willing to join this campaign and not so much, you know, forget the name on top of the campaign, but what this campaign represents. This is an abolitionist movement. We are still abolitionists. And again, I cannot lie. I got that term from you and Max. Not that I didn't know this term, but it wasn't being used in a modern lexicon. We weren't using that term now in the here and now today in 2016. And after I heard you all use the term and got to speak to you all, and you actually got me to realize that I was still fighting the abolitionist battle, I've adopted that term, and that's what this is, an abolitionist movement and campaign. And so anyone who is vested in that same movement, I ask them to join this campaign and volunteer.
And how can they do that? Is there a telephone number they should call, a website they should visit? We have linked to your campaign's social media pages on Facebook and Twitter. But if a person in that area that lives in the state of Maryland, and specifically if they live in Baltimore, and more specifically if they live in District 5 of Baltimore, how can they get in touch with your campaign?
Yes, my direct phone number is 443-865-3364. It's 443-865-3364. And my campaign website is www.ervinforcitycouncil.com. That's E-R-V as in Victor, E-R-V-I-N forcitycouncil.com.
I appreciate you pointing out the abolitionist, the term abolitionist, and how it has not been used in a modern, you know, to apply to modern times, and not using that in our vocabulary. And in fact, it is accurate to use that, because what we are up against is 21st century slavery and human trafficking. And if we want to get technical about the law, the 13th Amendment, which, you know, Christopher, does not abolish slavery, but makes an exception for it, and transforms it to prison slavery, prison through the jails and prison cells and whatnot. Now, is this your first time seeking public office, Mr. Ervin?
It absolutely is. I've never ran for any office before and never wanted to. And to be honest with you, I don't want to run for an office now. This is not politics. Politics is not fun for me. I've never had any aspirations of being in politics. And to be honest, if I win, I will not play politics. It is about a movement. It's about what people need in a district. There are a lot of underserved areas of my district. There are a lot of areas that receive attention, but even within those areas, that attention has been very selective.
What has the experience been like? Because to be honest with you, you kind of inspired me, Mr. Ervin, and I've been thinking about not this election cycle, but in the future, possibly getting into North Carolina state politics and possibly running for state senator or house position, even if it's just county commissioner. But you've inspired me to get into, you know, that people activity area and trying to fight, you know, institutional racism through that avenue. Not saying that I'm abandoning other avenues, but that is an area that I think is sorely neglected among us as a distinct group of people here in the United States, as a distinct voting bloc. So how has that experience been? Because, you know, we've heard a whole lot of nightmare stories, like, you know, you're constantly on the go, the stress of trying to raise money so that you can get your message out there, and just organizing. And so how has that experience been for you?
It is exactly as you just outlined it. Very stressful, very tiring. It's a constant hustle and bustle. And if you think about everything that you and I just outlined with the campaign, you add to it that we're in a legislative session and I'm working on a couple of bills towards expungement, again, abolitionist related activity. So you can double everything that we outlined as negative, and that's what I'm dealing with. But that said, that's the fight. What I'm finding out when I knock on doors are people are so disengaged from the process because no one has ever knocked on their door in our district. These are the neighborhoods where people are most underserved, people who look like me, look like you, and they have never seen political representation come to their door or to speak to their issues. When we talk about abolition, we have to think about, again, that 13th Amendment and that exception. That is policy. Policy is created by politicians and ultimately enforced by the police. So if we have problems with policy, yelling at police is not going to change. If we have problems with policy, yelling at a building with a bullhorn is not going to change it. We need to put people who align with our agenda, with our goals and objectives. We need to get those people in office so that they can affect policy from the tables where policy is written. And from there, we can change the dynamic.
No, speaking of policy, again, as I was telling the listeners prior to us contacting you, is that you've been a friend of the network. You've made several appearances on Black Talk Radio Network related to policy work that you have been engaged in for at least since we've been associated with each other for the past, year and a half, 2 years. And so I got to imagine that experience of which you already engaging the system on the legislative side, that perhaps that kind of prepared you for this campaign. How much do you think that experience has helped you?
It's been invaluable. There's no doubt about it. Going through these processes of legislative sessions and lobbying and dealing with different groups and talking to people has absolutely prepared me for the campaign. But let me say that even within that, there have been detractors from me running for office. There have been detractors from me fighting for this kind of legislation. And people say, why now? Maryland's not ready now. And just 2 years ago at the outset, I had people telling me that we would never get the right to vote back in the state of Maryland. And here we are, prepared for people to go and vote because someone decided to fight for it.
You mean felony voting, to be clear, right?
Yeah, to be clear, felony voting, that's right. People who served time, or even if they just took a plea and walked out of a courtroom and ended up on parole and probation, they can now vote immediately as of March 10th when the law takes effect. And so overall, the thing is that there has to be determination and fortitude behind any effort. While there's a process that you can gain experience from, we have to be resigned to the fact that it's going to be a fight. When you step in the ring, if you think you're just going to walk in and knock somebody out, well, that's dreaming. In the real world, people hit back. And so you're going to take some blows, and there's going to be times where you don't want to come out for the next bell. But this is what we have to be. We have to find more of that fortitude that just says, you know what, if there's going to be a fight, it's going to be a fight all day tomorrow and next week, too. Let's get it.
Now, looking at the race specifically, again, you're running for a district 5 city council seat in Baltimore. And I was taking a look at, the overall campaign, or the race, I should say, of the campaign, different candidates. And it appears you have 6 other candidates. They all appear to be, registered as Democrats or running as Democrats. And are they all running for one seat? Or is that your competition for one seat? Or does this involve a number of seats, like an open seat on a city council if you don't get District 5 or whatnot? Can you explain that?
No, the 5th district is one district out of 14. And if you do not win, then you just do not win. There's no secondary seat to fall back to.
So you're in the crowded field.
I'm sorry?
It's accurate to say that you're running in the crowded field.
Yeah. Baltimore is a strange dynamic now. We have, I believe, somewhere around 30 people running for mayor. It's crazy. But in my district specifically, in my district, in the 5th district, there's it's probably the least known, highest profile story not being told in Baltimore. The city council person that had that seat held that seat since 1977. Not only the longest serving person in the history of Baltimore City, but the longest serving elected person in the history of the state of Maryland. The district is comprised of a large population of both Christian, Muslim, and Jewish people, and she was a Jewish woman who had been serving in that seat since 1977, though like Baltimore City, it's a majority Black. And so there's a lot of tangibles and intangibles that go into it, but this will be a historic vote because no matter what, she will not be coming back. And it's like I said, it's also probably the least talked about district in the city, so it's very strange.
Does it, has there been any debates that have occurred in the past concerning all the field that you find yourself running among for the seat in the 5th District? Or are there any plans to have any debates? Or are you challenging anyone? You know what I'm saying? To debate you on the issues?
There has not been a single debate thus far. There have been several forums, and I, for one, have been requesting a debate. I want a debate. I want us to have to address each other on issues that we say that we know about or stand on. I don't like these questions from a committee. They give you a short question, and it really doesn't relate to anything. And some people got the question ahead of time, and others didn't. No, we should have an open debate where we have to spontaneously address issues and come off of the top of the head, come off of the head, just freestyle. You should know in your heart already what you stand for and how you want to address issues. And so let's see how people respond to these issues. Let's hear what people say they want to do when they're able to sit in front of the people in the district who are affected by the different policies and conditions that we say we're running to change.
What, just for some political education, how can a person such as yourself, an abolitionist, how can you affect policy change from the city council for the District 5? What ways can you affect policy change that will improve the lives of, you know, the citizens of District 5? What are the things that you're focusing on the different areas?
Well, for one, when we talk about slavery, when we talk about the need for expungement in an abolitionist way, we're talking about things that affect the economics. And so from the very outset of that, like I said, there's a resolution on the floor of City Hall now that one of the current sitting city council people sponsored for me. And that's recognizing the bill that is being proposed at the state level. And so there's a resolution to adopt nonviolent felony expungement within the city of Baltimore. Now, many people involved in politics know that resolutions really don't mean much. But what it does is set a precedent, because these bills are in both the Senate and the House now cross-filed. With that said, again, that felony record affects people's ability to be hired, to get housing and education and so forth. And so one of the things that I will do as a sitting city council person and have already begun to work on is bringing a bridge industry to Baltimore. And what I mean when I say bridge industry, we have to understand that Baltimore is a blue-collar, old-school town like Detroit, Chicago, and Pittsburgh. Well, Baltimore used to have a steel mill. They used to have Park Sausage. We still have Park Sausage, but we used to have the automakers, these different types of blue-collar jobs. The thing about these old-school blue-collar jobs is that if you dropped out of high school, you could still go there and get a job that would sustain a family, buy you a house, a small piece of property, and you can live your life. Now in 2016, everything is about IT. Everything is about STEAM education, science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. The thing about that is right now, the people who are of working age and have a felony record can't get those jobs. So we're bringing industries such as green industries such as electronic waste, electronic recycling. We're bringing that back to Baltimore. That's what I'm working on. That's a low-tech, high labor-intensive industry. Low-tech, labor-intensive. Again, like the old-school blue-collar industries. Until we're ready for these kids who are learning technology-based curriculum to get into the workforce, we need, again, what I call bridge industries to get us to that time where people can actually still work and have a viable opportunity to provide for their families. I'm not hearing any of this talk from any of the other candidates. They're talking about things that sound good. They're not telling you exactly what their plan is to change the dynamic in my city. And I have a problem with that.
Before we let you go and get back to the event that you're attending, we've spoken to you in the past, and I know your position on police brutality. And, you know, we've talked to you since the Freddie Gray killing. And right now, Baltimore is conducting trials for the cops that were involved. So I know your position on police brutality, but there may be some who are hearing you for the first time. And so I want to preface my question, you know, in letting people hear your position on police brutality. But the Baltimore police have found themselves yet again, Mr. Urban, as you probably know, in another police brutality scandal with a cop being caught on video assaulting a teenager, with the police alleging that the teenagers were trespassing on school property and being disrespectful to officers. And like myself, other activists and even other people I've read their comments that live in Baltimore felt that the cop went too far and should be fired. And should not only be fired, but face prosecution for assault. Now, I'm not sure if it was the officer who was doing the hitting, you know, that was on the video, or if it was one who was just standing by watching. But one of the officers being investigated in this case was fired from the Baltimore County Police in 2003. Now, we hear a lot, Mr. Urban, about revolving doors in regards to prisons and recidivism, but what about the revolving doors of bad cops?
That's one of the questions that is going on here now. As you stated, that police officer was previously a police officer in another jurisdiction here in Maryland, another municipality, and was fired from there and was able to be rehired because they all go to the same training institute and they receive their police powers from the state of Maryland, and so they could take those powers and go to any jurisdiction, be it Baltimore City School Police, where he was employed, Baltimore City Police, the Sheriff's Department, any of the surrounding counties. And so this needs to be addressed. These are some of the provisions that are being addressed within the Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights. There's any number. I mean, we could do a whole separate show just on that. Maryland is such a police state. That many of these things need to be rethought and probably revised. There's no way in the world that an officer who is fired, deemed unacceptable behavior in any way, shape, or form, rendering them less than what should be accepted as a police officer, should be able to be fired in one place and go to another. I would also state that this is not unique to Maryland. And so that while we're talking about this right now, people should be cognizant of wherever they live that this may be going on. Officers who may have been fired from somewhere and hired somewhere else. And if I'm not mistaken, that may have been the case in Ferguson. If it wasn't
yes,
Ferguson,
it was
another one around that time.
Yes. Jennings Police Department was shut down, and Darren Wilson worked there. And once that department was shut down, that he ended up migrating over to Ferguson, and the rest is we know, you know, what he ended up doing in killing Michael Brown. So yes, that you're right. Correct. That was the case.
Yeah, this is you know, the way we're looking at policing. Let me take that back. This is not the way we're looking at anything. This is the way the country has been set up with us, with black people in particular, and increasingly Hispanics being considered the boogeyman. Where there's a boogeyman, and especially older people who make up the largest portion of the voters, wherever older people feel afraid, they will want protectors. And then the police can be the people who step into that role, and where the protector can make the sheep feel endangered enough, the sheep will allow the protector to go as far as necessary. And this is the reason I tie expungement into this, because look how many times something is done to someone who was considered unarmed, considered not to be a threat. And then afterward, what's posted everywhere is that person's past criminal record. And then somehow that serves as justification for the police killing someone who was deemed not a threat, unarmed, and everything else. There's nothing left in the air to make it seem justifiable other than this person's past history. I think we need to look at this entire picture of policing in America and rethink how we approach this. Remember, when you sit back and say that there's nothing you can do, you're actually allowing it to continue, and it will get worse.
Yes, sir. Just quick thoughts as I was listening to you talk about, you know, this shouldn't happen, this shuffling of officers around these different departments, whether they're in the same state or, and in some cases, they go to another state. But I was just thinking about my time in the military and then this Donald Trump supporter who was seen verbally and physically abusing a black woman at one of his rallies, where he was prevented from joining the Marine Corps because of his activity. And that is something that, you know, I'm remembering from my time in the military. You don't get kicked out of the United States Army and then think you're going to go enlist in the United States Marines or the United States Air Force or the United States Navy. If you get kicked out of one of those departments or branches of the United States military, your record follows you and you will not be able to be shuffled around like that. And it makes only common sense that that should apply to officers as well, police officers and departments as well. Just common sense to me.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I had a somewhat similar conversation with our Chief Commissioner Kevin Davis here in Baltimore. And what I said to him and several of his commanders at the time is that the Baltimore City Police Department, as well as police across this country, would benefit from what the military has, which is the UCMJ. What we currently have, the UCMJ, for those who don't know, is the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It is a standard that everyone in the military is held to. And what that produces is when you saw the movie A Few Good Men, Tom Cruise was a Navy JAG officer, Judge Advocate General, and Jack Nicholson, a Marine colonel, was on trial for the actions of his subordinates in the killing of a private or a lance corporal, I forget what rank it was. Now, what we currently see, when is the last time you saw a captain, a colonel, a police officer on trial for what his subordinates have done? And with the police department, you have the FOP protecting the police from everything that they do. While in the military, you have, again, that judge advocate, you have a military body that makes sure that everyone is accountable for a standard and will go after them with the fullest extent that the military law allows. I think police departments across the country need to adopt something like that.
Most certainly, but, you know, you would, when you try to translate that to a civilian model, that is supposed to be the role of the prosecutors. But, of course, then we're opening up a whole nother issue right there. You know, even though they're interconnected, is you know, the role of the prosecutors and also preventing accountability in regards to these officers.
Scotty, if you think about it, whatever happens on a military base within the confines of the United States, mm-hmm. If it happens on base or off base,
right.
Especially if it happens off base, that person faces the UCMJ, but they are also facing local prosecution.
That's true.
I think that,
that's
true. And so again, we're talking about, you know, we call the police paramilitary, which translates to like military.
Right.
I would ask you, what's different? And since they do have the abilities that they do, and many of their jurisdictions will cross lines, county lines within the same state, I don't see why they shouldn't have something similar. I wouldn't necessarily say they should have the UCMJ, but something very similar that mm-hmm. holds them with all of the power that they have. What cartoon or whatever it was, with great power comes great responsibility. Well, with great power and great responsibility should come great prosecution.
Yeah, great, consequences for your actions.
Absolutely.
Right. All right, well, I want to thank you again, Mr. Irvin, but before you leave us, please tell people how they can contribute to your campaign to take a city council seat in Maryland in District 5. How can they contribute either monetarily or by volunteering?
My website, again, is www.irvinforcitycouncil, E-R-V-I-N, the word for F-O-R, citycouncil, C-I-T-Y-C-O-U, IrvinForCityCouncil.com, IrvinForCityCouncil.com. There's a tab on there that you can volunteer. There's a tab that you can donate with PayPal or straight from your account if you wish. But what I really ask people to understand, again, as I stated earlier, is that I've never run for an office before, never have, never wanted to. I am one of the affected people by mass incarceration. I have been incarcerated in the state of Maryland, not just in the city detention center, but in the state center. And in the state of Maryland, once you have finished your time and everything, you can't run for office. And so I've chosen to. So in supporting me, you will not be just supporting another politician. You will be supporting someone who is fighting the system that they were impacted by. It is time to let the impacted people speak for ourselves and stop having people speak for us. So with that, I thank you for giving me this opportunity, Scotty, and I'm always available to you in Abolitionist Radio.
Thank you again, Mr. Christopher Irvin, and we definitely want to keep getting regular updates with you from you more frequently because, again, the election is when? It's April the 26th, right?
That's right. And early voting is April 14th through 21st. So even with that, we people should know that now that people have received their right to vote back, they have all of the privileges that come with it. So they can early vote as well as absentee vote April 14th through 21st.
That's great. That's great. Thank you and much success to your campaign, Mr. Irvin. We'll be in touch.
Thanks again, Scotty.
All right, that was Mr. Christopher Irvin. Allow him to get back to the event that he is attending. But again, you know, he pretty much speaks for himself. Abolitionist, not shy about it, acknowledges the problem. He is not a reformer. He is an abolitionist. And, you know, I hope that he can win a seat in District 5 in Baltimore City Council. And try to bring some relief from racism and white supremacy to the victims in that district. All right, going to take a station identification break, kick some message music. If you have any questions, comments, observations you would like to share, give us a call, 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549-032-POUND. Hit star 6 and 1 if you would like to come in on air. You can also listen in or call in with the web-based flash phone using those same conference line numbers and codes. And the last way is to call us on a studio line. That's 704-951-5030. Again, that is 704-951-5030. We'll be right back.
Fake dog, no love, you get the slug. CB4, gusto, your luck though. I didn't know till I was drunk though. You weak cats are played out, get robbed and laid out. Can't be no turn snitch, I got the right out. 96 rays I made out, Montana way, the good FBLLA. Verbal AK spray, dip detaching, jump out the range, empty out the ashtray. A glass is eight, making mad gas display. Red dot plot, murder scan, 32 shots rung. Regulate with my thun, 17 rocks clean for one ring. Yo, let me let y'all people know one thing. There's one life, one love, so there can only be one king.
Make Black Talk Radio your choice for digital black radio. New black media for the new millennium.
Our people are very serious about not being very serious.
Now let's put it all in perspective before the outrage burns out misdirected. What can we do so our community protected? I believe that should be our main objective. While we full of rage and we want to make a difference, let's do more than protest. Let's make a commitment to be proactive, not just emotional, reactive. Move like G, never passive. Organize state teams, martial arts classes. Get to the gun range and make your aim active. Self-defense is a must by any tactic. Security protocol, make it a daily practice. They say I look suspicious. I get it all the time.
And welcome back to Black Talk Radio News. Again, Scotty Reed is in for this broadcast from behind these enemy lines. So, I want to talk about last night. You had Senator Bernie Sanders and Mrs. Hillary Clinton square off in a political debate on CNN last night. At the beginning of the program, I talked about Hillary Clinton dodging Don Lemon's very pointed question about if she knew or if she was using racial code when in she was giving different speeches back in the 1990s in support of the 1994 crime bill that was put together by Bill Clinton, her husband, and the Republicans. And when she was pushing that to the public, she was calling children super predators and saying that they're not just gangs of kids anymore, they're super predators, and they have no empathy, they have no conscience, nothing, you know, the very things that we just heard Christopher Irvin talking about, when even today that super predator theory is used. But today we're, you know, thugs and hoodies and same language. And Hillary Clinton dodged that question and started talking about other issues non-related to the fact that she was using racist language back in the day. And again, as I stated at the beginning of the program, this was in the 1990s when I was in my early to late 20s. Obviously, I turned 20 years old. When did I turn 20? In 1987, I believe, 1988. So I was in my 20s in the 1990s, early 30s. And I remember vividly the racist language of the Rush Limbaughs. And I don't think I ever heard of what's the guy's name on Fox News, Bill O'Reilly. I don't think Bill O'Reilly was around back then. I do recall seeing like Fox News though, but Rush Limbaugh certainly was around in local right-wing talk radio. I would listen to it wherever I was, and certainly they used that as racist dog whistles. And so the implication is, if she'd answered yes instead of just saying, or no, you know, she didn't even answer the question, just said it, you know, I shouldn't have used that language. She didn't say if she knew it was racist or not, but I'm telling you, she knew, just like every other person who was participating or aware of what was going on in politics in the 1990s, we knew that. So that really stands out in my mind. Totally unexpected question from Don Lemon, because he prefaced it by saying, I'm a black man. I'm a black man, and as a black man, I want to know if in the 1990s, when you was promoting a super predator theory, did you know that that was racist code? Or was you using racist code? Or whatever. Yes. The answer is yes, yes, yes. And as I stated on Twitter, young black child by the name of Justice, who is a co-host on the Context of White Supremacy, when she was questioning Tim Wise and he didn't directly answer her question, and he just started talking, spewing all these words, 1,000 words per minute, and she just told him, you're just, you know, spewing buckets and buckets of words. And that certainly could be said of what Hillary Clinton was doing last night when asked by Don Lemon if she was using racist code in the 1990s. Now, here is the thing, though, that I really want to focus on in terms of the debate they touched upon briefly about free public colleges and universities. And the key word that people seem to miss is public. Public colleges and universities, not private universities, not your Ivy Leagues, not Harvard, no, the U.S. government or state governments are not talking about sending our kids to Harvard or Princeton or Yale or any, you know, school like that where, you know, we would be in debt for another 100 years or whatnot if we sent our kids there. No, we're talking about public colleges and universities. We're talking like a North Carolina State. All right, North Carolina State University. We're talking about where I went to school, Central Piedmont Community College in Charlotte, North Carolina. Another school I attended, Gaston College in Gaston County. These are all public colleges and universities. What make those schools public? Well, the fact that they get public taxpayer funds is part of their budget. And so, in fact, we're already paying for these public colleges and universities. And so to address, you know, college affordability issues and to address college debt, this proposal by Bernie Sanders to make four-year tuition-free public colleges and universities available to everyone in the United States is certainly doable. And Hillary Clinton and her team is trying to make this seem like this is just a pipe dream. This is just so out of the ordinary. We will never be able to fund this. I don't, you know, and then throw in stuff that ain't even got nothing to do with it. Like, oh, I don't think that the American people should be paying for Donald Trump's and billionaires' kids to go to school. If you think your billionaire is sending his kid to Gaston College or Central Piedmont University or Central Piedmont Community College or North Carolina State University, you're sorely mistaken. Unless that kid is in a rebel stage or whatnot and they don't want nothing from Daddy Warbucks and they say, you know what, I don't want to go to Harvard. I'm going to North Carolina State University and get a more realistic multicultural experience by going to a public university and whatnot for free, you know. So I don't need your help, pops. I don't need your help, moms. It's there. I can go. I mean, come on, man. But that is not going to be the norm. You know that's not going to be the norm. And then we also know every individual who may be eligible to go to college won't go to college. They will not go. So, you know, trying to make it seem like this is just so far out of the realm of possibilities that we can't pay for it, when certainly we can pay for wars, we can pay for, you know, all of this military weaponry and whatnot. I mean, spending billions of dollars on a single plane, or at least hundreds of millions on a single Air Force fighter jet and whatnot. Man, we can pay for anything that we want to pay for. That's the point. Do we want to pay for them? And Hillary Clinton does not want to pay for public free tuition to public colleges and universities. Why might that be? Well, it could have something to do with the fact that she has accepted money for a very long time throughout her political career from the very industries that profit off of college debt and whatnot. Now, people want to talk about, you know, try to say that she is more like Obama. And then there's black people falling for that crap, too, saying she's, well, like last night, oh, she supported the auto bailouts of President Obama. And people said the auto industry would have ended if he didn't support it. Well, it was part of a broader package. All right. It wasn't that cut and dry and simple. It was part of a broader package that was going to bail out Wall Street criminals, and I say criminals not as slang, not as a metaphor, but as a matter of fact. These were people who engaged in criminal activity and were never prosecuted for. And on top of that, then they got billions of dollars to bail out the companies that they destroyed. Okay. So it is certainly doable, but President Obama actually does support that. And this is the biggest fault that I find with Bernie Sanders' campaign and Bernie Sanders, the candidate. He is an old man, all right? I think he might be in his 70s or something like that. And while he's still lucid and whatnot, and I'm not trying to say he's ready for the rest home and we see dementia about to set in or Alzheimer's, you know, he's very much a functioning human being, very much still in possession of his intellect, but he is a little slow and he doesn't always get it. You know, he always doesn't pick up on when he should talk about this or talk about that or seize upon this opening that Hillary Clinton has given him, or how, you know, because a perfect time for while she was trying to act like he was anti-Obama, and he could have brought up the fact that Obama, as of September of 2015, he renewed his push to make public colleges free for 2 years. 2 years. You can get an associate's degree in 2 years. You can get it at a college, community college like Gaston College, You can get a you can take courses in refrigerants and whatnot, and get in the service sector. One of my cousins went to Gaston College to become an electrician, and he did it in less than 2 years. All right. And so, you know, 2 years, that's something that President Obama and others certainly think is doable. So why, you know, can't we extend that by another 2 years? But I'm hearing black people, people in my own family, saying stuff to me that they know they didn't come up with, and that they got it straight out of Hillary Clinton's mouth. But they're saying, oh, we can't have free stuff. You know, all this free stuff, somebody got to pay for it, and all blah, 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 blah. That's right-wing talking points. And again, they certainly can find money when they want to pay for, let's say, rearming Israel so it can continue to bomb and shoot and obliterate people in Gaza over the summer. Was that last summer or the summer before? They certainly can come up with trillions of dollars for the military budget and wasting money on unnecessary wars of aggression and unnecessary military technology and whatnot. They can find money to pay for anything they doggone want to pay for. And it doesn't even, you know, it's not like, you know, it costs a lot of money. It costs too much for some people to even attend. That's how we have, you know, the level of poverty we have in this country, that children are unable to even afford to go to community college for 2 years to get an associate's degree. Poverty is real. But you can't tell me we can't. That is not something that's doable. And it certainly is doable. President Obama thinks it is, but yet black people will say, black people have said, oh, that's just free stuff. We don't want free stuff, you know, because niggas always got the stereotype of all we want is free stuff. Let me tell you something. In the people activity area of politics, everybody wants something. Everybody is trying to get something for free that they ain't got to pay for. In fact, they probably already paid for it through their taxes, and they're just trying to get those taxes redirected from unnecessary war expenses to providing education for the most vulnerable of our population, and that's poor people, and primarily black people. These are same people that say that the United States owe reparations. But yet you saying you don't want free colleges and universities because somebody got to pay for it? And we shouldn't want free stuff? How in the heck is that logical? That's not logical. That's contradicting yourself. But it just goes to show you the power of propaganda, and it also goes to show you the deception that some of us are just so willing to engage in. Stuff that don't even make sense. So, yeah, President Obama in September formed a coalition of community college leaders, educators, politicians, foundations, and businesses that will work to spread the existing different free two-year college models and recruit others interested in pushing the free tuition message nationally during his visit at Michigan's Macomb Community College. Now, they were in Michigan last night, and Hillary Clinton, you know, brought up the dilapidated school, elementary school, with the rats and the mold and all of that, when she was supposed to be asking a question about her using racism, practicing racism in language in the 90s, you know. But this was in this article, or this excerpt I just read to you, is from September 2015, when President Obama was in Michigan pushing the ideal, trying to garner support for free public tuition at colleges and universities, public colleges and universities. That's what a community college is. It's a public college. So they're just, I mean, it's just baffling to me. It's just baffling that someone as informed and educated as my uncle, who is in his 70s, just turned, I think he in his early 70s. Very active man. He's still working. I think he still drives trucks and whatnot if he hasn't retired by now. You know, for him to repeat Hillary Clinton's talking points about free stuff, they just really, I let my uncle know it because we have these heated conversations a lot. Not that I'm a Republican or a conservative, but I try to get him to see that Democrats really ain't no better. They're just more codified at their racism. And he, you know, he'll throw the crumb versus getting nothing. You know, from Republicans on, you know, he'll throw that up at me and I'll be like, you know, yeah, crumbs is good. People need crumbs to survive and whatnot. But at the same time, let's not act like the Democrats on the flip side ain't putting people in these precarious positions of 21st century slavery and human trafficking. So I just wanted to point that out. I'm not going to spend any more time talking about that. So, you know, just ask questions. Ask questions. Don't just, you know, accept what these liars are telling you. That is so undoable. Every industrialized nation on the face of the earth got free colleges and universities, public colleges and universities. Everyone. European schools, even some of them Arabic schools. Libya. Before, you know, Hillary Clinton and Obama overthrew Libya, he was paying, Gaddafi's government was paying for these people to go to college, even abroad, to any college they wanted to. And you gonna tell me we can't afford free public colleges and universities? We can't subsidize that. Hell, make the NCAA subsidize it and share those billions of dollars they're generating annually off of college sports. Let that go towards providing free colleges and you don't act like we can't do it. There's a number of ways it can be done. Hillary Clinton just doesn't want it done. She wants you to focus on addressing people with current college debt, which there's a lot of them and they certainly need help. But to me, the more important thing to do is prevent a new generation from becoming trapped in that same paradigm of crushing student debt. By making colleges free, public colleges free. It's not that far out of an ideal. It's actually quite practical. And I'm sure it will help lift a lot of people out of poverty or at least give them better standing in the job market to compete for jobs or careers. It just makes sense to me. The last thing that I want to share with you before I get off air, Tando Radio Show will be coming up at 6 o'clock p.m. Brother Dave will be wrapping up our live streaming for today. But y'all do know that Black Talk Radio Network is streaming 24/7. There's always something playing, whether it's a lecture from some of our black scholars and others, whether it is pre-recorded content from prior programs. And whatnot, there's all, whether it's message music, there's always something running on the digital radio station, Black Talk Radio. But the last thing that I want to cover with you, state of North Carolina is asking, they have a study committee that they have put together. They're having public hearings on Capitol monuments. It says on the website, throughout March, we're hosting public hearings on how we can best diversify the monuments on the state capitol grounds. Join us and share your opinion. I believe on those state capitol grounds, while they don't have Confederate flags or nothing like that, they do have some monuments to some former governors. This one guy who was like an education advocate and really fought hard for public education, but he was a racist white supremacist. He got a statue up there or whatnot. But now they want to have public hearings on working on a statue. They were supposed to. They do have plans to create monuments commemorating women as well as Native Americans, which I'm a descendant of Cherokee, North Carolina Cherokee Indians, as well as black people and African descended people, which I'm also a descendant of here in North Carolina. So They are, this is what it says on the website, a memorial can serve to recall the past, to commemorate people and events that brought us to the present moment, to create a cause for contemplation or a sense of awe. At the request of Governor Pat McCrory, the North Carolina Historical Commission and the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission will examine alternatives with respect to diversifying the memorials on the state capitol grounds to address the underrepresentation of African Americans. I think underrepresentation is an understatement. It's probably zero. All right. Governor Pat McCrory and the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources invite you to join the process to help determine how to proceed with this project. Some of the upcoming hearings they will have in March. Greensboro, they had one on March the 1st. That was a Tuesday in Greensboro, North Carolina. Let me see. The next one is going to be in Charlotte, North Carolina, on March the 8th at 6:30 p.m. Eastern, of course, Harvey B. Gantt Center for African American Culture. That's at 551 South Tryon Street. Again, that's in Charlotte. They will be also on March the 22nd having public hearings on this topic. That's a Tuesday, March 22nd, 6:30 p.m., Braswell Memorial Library. That's at 727 North Gray Street in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. And then the last one will be March the 29th at 6:30 p.m. on a Tuesday at Shaw Auditorium at Fayetteville State University, which is located at 1200 Marchison Road, which is in Fayetteville. I think that's a historically black college and university. I think it should be free to go to the black college and historic universities. They get public funds, don't they? All right. Anyway, so if you're unable to attend, I have linked to the online form where you can submit your comments. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to attend the event that's on a Tuesday at 6:30 in Charlotte, because, you know, I have my broadcasting duties I have to do as station manager. And right now don't have another engineer to continue the programming, and Tuesday is kind of a busy day, so I won't be able to attend. But I did submit my comment, and here was my comment. My comment was talking about this memorial should incorporate the remembrance or memorializing the African descendant people, the 400 revolutionary soldiers that the colony, because see, North Carolina was one of the original 13 colonies, but they sent 400, at least 400, could have been more, but at least 400 soldiers of African descent were sent from North Carolina to fight in the Continental Army. This was after the racist ban that George Washington had on black people serving in the Continental Army and fighting in the Revolutionary War. But again, as I've stated in prior broadcasts, he found himself outnumbered by the British and their allies. And so he had no choice but to allow black men, I'm not sure about any women, but black men to fight in the Continental Army. And indeed, without them, the United States would possibly still be a British colony or a French colony of some European power, if not for black people, if not for African soldiers. Now, some of them were enslaved Africans, some of them were not enslaved. They were free black people who were just having racism practiced against them by the likes of vicious white supremacists, enslavers like George Washington. So that's part of our history, that here in North Carolina, of black people, original colonists, that does not get told. Now, I went to public school here in North Carolina. I went to high school and junior high here in North Carolina. At in no point in our history lessons did they ever tell me about the African Revolutionary soldiers from North Carolina that helped win the American Revolutionary War. So North Carolina needs to incorporate those individuals and their great sacrifice, you know, in any memorial. And then, you know, we can also look at the black soldiers of North Carolina that enlisted in the Union Army to defeat these racist crackers down here, these racist white supremacists fighting for the Confederacy. We need to memorialize them as well, give them their recognition. I mean, every single war, the United States, just about every single war the United States has engaged in, black people have been a major part of that, right? They wouldn't have been able to build this empire without us. And I'm not saying that's necessarily a good thing, but just recognizing the history, black people were all not just enslaved Africans, were revolutionaries, right? We were Union soldiers. We were scouts. We were guys. We were cavalry soldiers. And all of us were not enslaved Africans, man. Not that there's anything wrong with it. And they need to be recognized. The victims of North Carolina chattel slavery should be memorialized too. So I'm like, what this other guy suggested was a collage of these people, these various people. I would like to see Robert F. Williams be recognized in this collage, him and his wife, Mabel Williams, North Carolina freedom fighters, you know what I'm saying? Started the Black Guard, not even 30 miles from where I sit right now in Monroe, North Carolina, where they picked up the gun, got a charter from the NRA, and started a rifle club called the Black Guard, and how they did battle with the Klan, did battle with the racist police. I'm talking about shooting battles. I ain't talking about no words. I'm hurling words at each other and things of that. And they, no. That wasn't going on. They even had to help save some of the Freedom Riders. You know, they came down here want to integrate buses and whatnot, and they traveling, and the Klan and the police attacked them. And the Black Guard had to come with rifles in hand and save them. This is who we are. These are our stories that's not being told, that are not being recognized. Certainly we had people that participated in the sit-ins during the 60s, the lunch counter sit-ins through colleges, you know, the college students and whatnot. So our history is rich, our history is diverse, and our history is not just limited to being victims of chattel slavery. And you have to think about this. Why does the white supremacists who write these history textbooks, who make these movies, who are in control of popular culture and whatnot, why is it that that's all they tell people? They tell the world that all black Americans are descendants of enslaved Africans. That's it. That's all they tell us. That's all they tell the world. I mean, think about that from the perspective of a child. If all you growing up, if all only your heroes are victims, all your heroes are victims, you know, again, ain't nothing wrong with it. Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, all former enslaved Africans, rich history, fighters, freedom fighters, whatnot. Nothing wrong with if you are a descendant of an enslaved African, but the fact is that our history is much more diverse than that. So why are we allowing them to limit us to that narrow piece of our history on this continent? Indeed, we were here before Columbus. So, you know, those are my thoughts on that. And I probably will try to get some of my relatives here in North Carolina and my neighbors to also submit the same thing, you know, saying to recognize from the revolutionary, the black revolutionary soldier of North Carolina all the way up to, you know, I don't think we ever had a black governor, but, you know, Robert Williams in the 1960s and whatnot. So, yeah, we got rich. Diverse history as black people who are native to North Carolina. All right, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up the program. Again, coming up in about 35 minutes, Tando Radio Show will be on air at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. Make sure that y'all either stay tuned or check back in. at that time for some more live programming. I will be back on air tomorrow. Tomorrow's Tuesday at 4 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time with another episode of Black Talk Radio News. Recognize the fact that you do, in fact, live behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. Slavery has never been abolished, and they're still practicing slavery. And we live in a police state. The entire United States is a police state. And casualties are being created every day. And in order for us to reduce the possibilities that we become easy casualties, all right, we need to develop skills and awareness so that we don't get caught with our pants down out here on the battlefield, with our powder wet, so to speak, as they say. All right, till tomorrow, peace and blessings to all.
May appear a confusing blur of activity, each ant doing its own thing, but it can't be. Somehow the ants coordinate their actions so that large insects are overwhelmed, killed, and carried back to the base.
Pairs is dying and my people are suffering. The money's still low, you should see how they budgeting.
Just watch what comes out your mouth.
People are suffering. It's elementary, they want us all gone eventually. Pairs is dying, people are suffering. The money's still low, you should see how they budgeting. Pairs is dying, and my people are suffering. The money's still low, they want us all gone eventually.